It's Thursday, September 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Doug Bernard in Washington. Coming up this half hour, President Trump's agenda hits an iceberg called the U.S. Senate. New research connects a poor night's sleep with worsening health. And excuse me, but is that your iPhone I'm smelling?
The connection with emotion, memories, and the potential to use the sense of smell, the odors under the threshold, under the awareness, is incredible what we can do with technology.
It's all ahead on International Edition. An Australian-based Saudi women's rights activist who escaped a public flogging for driving in Saudi Arabia has vowed to return to her native country and become one of the first to legally get behind the wheel. This follows Tuesday's royal decree by King Salman allowing women to drive. The kingdom has long been criticized as the only country that barred women drivers. The order is set to be fully implemented by June 24th next year, and it's one piece of a set of reforms called Vision 2030, put in motion by the king, who took over in 2015, and his son, 32-year-old Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Some women have been engaged in decades of struggle to gain the right to drive, including Manal al-Sharif, who took part in the Women to Drive protest movement. She spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty.
I was in tears. I couldn't believe it took 27 years from the first protest.
What will it mean for women?
I don't think anything will emancipate women in my country more than driving their own car. I know it sounds ridiculous and it sounds mundane act, everyday act in other countries, but it's not the case in Saudi Arabia. I've been fighting for this right for a long time, and we've been deprived from a basic right, the last country on earth that allowed women to drive. And women been losing a lot to be full citizens and participate fully in the economical growth of the country because of this simple basic human right of mobility, it's been stripped away from them. So it means a lot. Saudi Arabia will never be the same after this historical day, I call it.
But will it improve economic opportunities, perhaps more jobs for women?
Exactly. We're 11% of the workforce, and that tells you something. Not only because the jobs women were being deprived from because they were women, they're not allowed to work with men. Not because only of that, even the women-only jobs, they've been deprived from because they couldn't find a mean of transportation to her job.
What prompted the king to issue this royal decree? Was it the protest movement? Was it a reform effort? What was it?
Believe me, Saudi Arabia is the country that you don't expect anything. You don't understand how things are happening in Saudi Arabia. Living in an absolute monarchy, these are things that you don't expect them. But I think there are so many factors that led to this, personally, believing. Many factors. First of all, there has been so much pressure from the international media and the international community in Saudi Arabia. We've been known as the last country on earth where women don't drive. Anywhere you go, the officials always been asked and pressured when women are going to be allowed to drive. And I can tell you just from the fact that I've been swamped with emails and phone calls and messages for interviews because of this decree. That tells you how much there is pressure on Saudi Arabia to just end this long-standing ban. Plus, the vision of 2030 that wants to empower women and raise the percentage of women in the workforce to 30%. You cannot do that and women are at the back seat and they're not allowed to drive.
Saudi women's rights champion Manal al-Sharif. And in further signs of change, a Saudi woman has been named to a senior government post. And additionally, a woman was selected as the spokesperson for the Saudi embassy in Washington. Well, I'm pleased to welcome Andrew Palcheski to our studio here. Andrew monitors social media as VOA's social media editor. Just as a quick note, Andrew, this whole women to drive protest movement really, and even in a place like Saudi Arabia, really got a lot of traction online. It's kind of an interesting example of some concrete examples where, you know, these social media campaigns can actually perhaps have some real world consequences and results. So
yeah, and it is a good example of that because the first story we're going to talk about today is an instance where social media definitely had an impact, but maybe not in a good way. You know, for weeks we've been talking about how Russia used Facebook to try to influence the U.S. presidential election. We talked about the $100,000 they spent on about 3,000 ads on different issues like guns and race and LGBT issues. We talked about the development that they purchased ads to stoke protests in Baltimore and Ferguson, Missouri after racially charged protests there. And then it's been revealed in the past few days that some of those ads were in support of candidates like Jill Stein, who was the Green Party candidate, and Bernie Sanders, who was running against Hillary Clinton in the Democratic primary. But it is not just Facebook that's in the spotlight. It's also Twitter, because there are reports now that Russian groups use Twitter to influence opinions during the 2016 presidential election through different bots and different targeted accounts to try to, just like they did with Facebook, influence opinions and support specific candidates. The Russian-linked accounts, though, weren't just focused on the election, we're finding out now. They're also tweeting about the NFL controversy and the national anthem debate, whether players should be kneeling or standing during the national anthem.
So still active as recently as this week.
Still active and trying to create more tension between those two sides of that debate. Now, it's worth noting Twitter is testifying, representatives from Twitter are testifying on Capitol Hill today about this Russian interference. I would not be surprised if they get some questions about some of the NFL tweets that have been coming out and that news being reported by a number of news outlets. So it's pervasive. It's not just Facebook, not just Twitter. It's really across the board. And as I've said time and time again, I think this is the tip of the iceberg. We're going to see more and more stories come out about how ingrained these Russian accounts were and how ingrained this influence was in the social media that we use and experience every day.
One can't be too surprised, I suppose, if you accept even some of the accusations of Russian connection with Facebook use and placing ads and trying to stir things up, that, that we see it on Twitter as well. The interesting thing is, though, that, well, maybe up until now, for most people, all of this was happening right under their nose, and nobody was even looking at it. No one was paying attention to it.
Yes, and that's maybe the, you know, one of the golden rules of social media. One is, you know, if you wouldn't say it in real life, don't put it up on social media. But the other one is, if you see it on social media, don't believe that it's true. Don't think that this is, oh, an activist or somebody tweeting about this, because it could be somebody thousands of miles away sitting in a, you know, a dark cubicle farm somewhere outside of Moscow.
Brother, I've been preaching that message for a while.
Yes. It's good to reiterate.
Absolutely. What else has got people talking out there?
Well, we went with that kind of dark story, so let's have a couple happy stories. Steve Scalise is the congressman from Louisiana who was shot on June 14th during that practice for the congressional baseball game. He spent a number of months in the hospital recovering. Today, he returned to the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives for the first time since that incident. Huge round of applause as he made his way to the floor, gave a very nice speech, and he took to his social media accounts and posted a photo of him and his wife Jennifer kind of silhouetted looking out from the speaker's balcony of the Capitol with just two words: "I'm back." So very nice moment. It was a nice moment with House Speaker Paul Ryan. He's a good friend of Scalise's. He saw him and kind of, you see this joy on his face as you know that his friend is back. But one of these rare moments of bipartisanship in Washington where Republicans and Democrats actually came together and wished him well. So that was very nice to see on social media. And to follow up on a story we talked about yesterday, lots of activism about the Jones Act, lifting that so foreign ships could come to Puerto Rico to help them with their hurricane relief. Well, President Trump has heard that message on social media, and he has lifted the Jones Act, so those supplies are making their way to Puerto Rico as we speak.
Interesting. Well, Andrew Palcheski, thank you as always for coming in, and thanks for the happy nice time story
as
well.
Yes, my pleasure.
Andrew Palcheski, VOA social media editor. Here are some of the top stories trending at this hour. China shutters North Korean-owned businesses, cutting foreign revenue for the North under UN sanctions. President Trump plans to dramatically reduce the number of refugees allowed into the U.S. in the coming year. A visit by UN officials to Myanmar's troubled Rakhine State Thursday was postponed due to, quote, bad weather. And two volcanoes, one in Indonesia, the other in Vanuatu, are threatening major eruptions. Expanded coverage on these stories and much more on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists in Chile have found a new heart failure treatment that uses umbilical cord-derived stem cells may lead to remarkable improvements in heart muscle function and quality of life for those suffering from this condition. The American Heart Association says heart failure means that your heart isn't pumping blood as it should and is unable to keep up with the body's need for blood and oxygen. Heart failure is usually treated with medication and changes in lifestyle. The researchers found that a year after heart failure patients were given this new treatment, they showed a significant and continued improvement in their heart's ability to pump blood and had an improved quality of life. They also found the treatment was safe with no adverse effects. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Doug Bernard in Washington. Well, Republican leaders in the U.S. Senate suffered a series of setbacks this week that could spell trouble for President Donald Trump's agenda and complicate Republican hopes of expanding or even holding their congressional majorities in midterm elections next year. VOA's Michael Bowman reports that an anti-establishment firebrand won a Republican primary contest Tuesday, just hours after the latest attempt to repeal Obamacare was shelved and an influential Republican senator announced his retirement.
For Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Tuesday brought a trifecta of bad news. First, despite intense pressure from President Trump, Republicans failed yet again to end Obamacare.
We don't have the votes. Okay.
Then a McConnell ally and leading voice on foreign affairs, Tennessee Republican Bob Corker, announced he will retire next year. Hours later, another McConnell foot soldier, Alabama Senator Luther Strange, lost a primary contest to an ultra-conservative populist challenger, Roy Moore.
I believe we can make America great, but we must make America good. We are one nation under God.
A former Alabama Supreme Court Chief Justice with fundamentalist biblical views, Moore could be a wild card within the Republican caucus if elected in December.
Because he's made no secret of his reputation as an outsider, as someone who's willing to buck party leaders and buck the establishment when it suits his purposes, that could well be a challenge for Majority Leader Mitch McConnell going forward.
Moore's victory is seen as a warning shot to Republicans on Capitol Hill.
When you're not able to achieve legislative victories on very important legislative issues like repealing Obamacare, it makes it much more difficult for incumbents to get reelected.
Having failed to repeal Obamacare, Republicans are turning to their next big agenda item, tax cuts.
This is our once-in-a-generation opportunity to fundamentally rethink our tax code. We can unleash the economy, promoting growth, attracting jobs.
But with Democrats rising in opposition,
this is not going to fly with the American people.
Republican unity will be put to the test in the 100-member Senate once again.
They do only have 52 members. And when you choose to legislate on a party line basis, you have to keep all of your senators in line.
Tax reform could be Republican lawmakers' last chance to make good on a major Trump agenda item heading into next year's midterm elections and to satisfy grassroots demands from within their party.
The Republican base voter is now a Trump voter, and they see any effort to stymie President Trump from the Republicans as a direct assault on them.
President Trump slammed Senate Republicans for failing to repeal Obamacare and is unlikely to withhold criticism if tax reform fails. Michael Bowman, VOA News, the Capitol.
Coming up, new technology brings the world of smell to your electronic devices. But first, it's estimated that nearly 40 million people in the U.S. alone suffer from some kind of chronic sleep deprivation. And a new study, perhaps the first of its kind, is shedding light on how and why humans sleep or don't. VOA's Kevin Enochs reports.
Canadian researchers studying sleep patterns chose the Hadza people in Tanzania because their environment is much the same as the one humans lived in a million years ago.
They're in one of the least light pollution status areas on the planet. In the West, 99% of every individual that lives in a post-industrial context is exposed to light pollution. So the Hadza are exposed to almost no light pollution at all.
Researcher David Sampson also says they live the same way as our ancestors did.
They are a group that uses foraging to survive. So they're hunter-gatherers. They're using the same subsistence strategy that our ancestors used in the same ecology for essentially for 1.8 million years. So they were really the perfect group to answer these questions with.
What Sampson and his team discovered is that the Hadza sleep at all kinds of times, not just at night.
We found something quite surprising, in fact. We found that their sleep was incredibly asynchronous. So by this I mean that it was very, very rare that any of the individuals were asleep all at the same time.
But why? The answer may be that life back then was really dangerous, and it made sense for somebody to always be on watch. By contrast, young people in advanced societies tend to stay up late and sleep late, while the elderly seem to go to sleep early and get up early.
As it turns out, this may have been an adaptive behavior, this short, fragmented sleep in elderly individuals and this shift to a more lark-like pattern. It may have been beneficial in an evolutionary context.
Sleep, it turns out, has never been a one-size-fits-all kind of a thing.
If there's one clinical jewel that we think emerges from this research, is that it normalizes variation in sleep patterns in humans. So we have this bias, this sort of propensity in the West to look at anything outside that bell curve that's non-normal and to label it or categorize it perhaps as a sleep disorder in this context.
And that much-needed afternoon nap may be a holdover from a time when staying awake at night meant everyone woke up alive. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
And you are listening to The Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Listening to International Edition, coming to you live from Washington. Would you buy a car that sprayed soothing aromas when you're stuck in rush hour traffic? Or how about a robot that has the scent of a real person? Well, believe it or not, scientists say that new technology means we will soon be using devices like these in our everyday lives. Henry Ridgewell visited this month's British Science Festival in Brighton, England to learn more.
Virtual reality with an added dimension. Scientists from Britain's University of Sussex have developed virtual worlds that even smell like the real thing. When users open a virtual door, in this case into a rainforest, diffusers spray the appropriate scent for added authenticity.
It is a really immersive experience that you have because you're exploring this environment and you have smells that correspond with it.
Smell technology has been tried before, memorably with Smell-O-Vision movies in the 1960s. These scientists say it's on the cusp of a comeback.
The connection with emotion, memories, and the potential to use the sense of smell, the odors under the threshold, under the awareness, is incredible what we can do with technology.
And not just for entertainment. Here, a driving simulator has been fitted with a scent diffuser.
In this demo, we wanted to deliver the smell of lavender every time the driver exceeds the speed. We chose lavender because it's a very calming smell.
Mobile phones could also send alerts using odors. Businesses are already experimenting with using scent to influence customers' behavior.
Not only for marketing in stores, so creating the logo brand, but in the other side you can create and stimulate impulse buying. So you're in a library, you smell coffee, and then actually you are unconscious, but you are suddenly having the need to drink a coffee.
Maggioni says scent is vital in human interactions. For example, when men smell tears, levels of testosterone are reduced and they show more empathy. That physiological reaction can be applied to new technology.
In the interaction with robots, how we can build trust with a robot if the robots smell like us.
An exciting and perhaps for some daunting future. Scientists say the sense of smell, until now largely unexploited, is about to be stimulated by the march of technology. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Brighton, England.
Smells a little fishy to me. But that is our program for today. Thanks for being with us. We hope you'll visit our website at voanews.com. And, of course, we hope you'll join us tomorrow for International Edition at the same time. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you again tomorrow.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Continuing a message of reform at the UN General Assembly's high-level week, Vice President Mike Pence lauded the UN Security Council's unanimous adoption of Resolution 2378, calling for improvements to UN peacekeeping operations.
President Trump and I firmly believe that the UN must act to make its peacekeeping operations more efficient, more effective, more accountable, and more credible.
The new resolution notes that conflict prevention remains primarily the responsibility of sovereign states and that the United Nations should support and complement the roles of national governments in settling disputes by peaceful means. Peacekeeping missions should not replace the pursuit of political resolution to conflicts. Mediation, ceasefire monitoring, and assistance in implementation of peace accords will continue to be central to the UN approach to keeping the peace. The resolution also calls for structural reforms to improve efficiency and mission planning. Vice President Pence noted that peacekeeping missions must have the consent of the host country and have realistic and achievable mandates. Every mission must have an exit strategy, and the United Nations peacekeeping missions must adjust to progress and failure, he said.
In short, when a mission succeeds, we should not prolong it. When a mission underperforms, we should restructure it. And when a mission consistently fails to fulfill the mandates of this council, we should end it.
The resolution underscores the need to increase the number of relevant pledges of capabilities, reinforces the importance of peacekeeper performance, and calls for specific steps to address issues regarding misconduct among peacekeeping troops. It also calls for improved partnerships with regional entities. We urge the United Nations to analyze all peacekeeping operations in light of these principles so that these missions most effectively advance peace across the wider world, said Vice President Pence. Noting the first words of the UN Charter to maintain international peace, he called on all member nations to rededicate themselves to this mission. Keeping the peace requires more than peacekeeping, he said. It requires action and the unwavering resolve of every country gathered here today.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.